You're tuned into WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and welcome to a brand new program here on WFMU. This is called Radio Free Culture. It's a monthly series that's going to take place the last Monday of every month here in the Too Much Information slot. Benjamin Walker has not disappeared. He shall return next week, but he's giving up the last Monday of every month from 6 to 7 p.m. for Radio Free Culture, where we'll be focusing on digital culture and discussing issues like net neutrality and the broadcast spectrum and piracy, digital rights, archives, libraries in the internet age. But at the end of the day, it will all be with WFMU's own particular digital viewpoint. We here at WFMU do have a vested interest in the internet, having more than twice as many internet listeners as we have FM listeners. And we strongly believe in the internet being a place where innovation can happen. We created the Free Music Archive a couple of years ago. And in fact, what we're hearing in the background to kick off the show is a track from the Free Music Archive by the band Yacht. This is called Shangri-La, and you can download it legally off the Free Music Archive and also off archive.org. We want to continue to innovate online and make internet broadcasting and social media as exciting as radio has always been. So various WFMU personalities are going to be hosting Radio Free Culture the last Monday of every month, and I'm here doing the first one. And I'm very, very excited to have with me as our first guest, Brewster Kahle, who is the founder and digital librarian of the Internet Archive. Brewster, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. So let's start off by introducing the thing that you do, which is, for lack of a better way, trying to get a copy of just about every piece of information in the world. Is that right?
Yeah. The idea is to try to build the Library of Alexandria version 2. Can you build basically a world where if anybody's curious enough can have access to the, well, books, music, video, anything that's ever been produced anywhere, anytime. And I think that's one of the promises of the internet, and the Internet Archive is trying to play a role in that.
And have you surpassed the Library of Alexandria in terms of how much information it had?
Well, they say that they had 300,000 scrolls back in 300 BC, but it was about 75% of all of the books ever written, whether it was in Egyptian or Greek or the Hebrews or the Hittites, whatever. And I wouldn't say we have 75%, so I think we're still being aced out by the Library of Alexandria in the ancient days. But we do have something going for us, is we can actually get these materials to people no matter where they are. So you don't have to go and be friends with the Ptolemies to be able to have access to the collections, either in the Internet Archive or the Internet in general. But, man, it's been sort of quirky in terms of all the rights issues. The technology issues have actually been working out pretty well.
How much information is on the Internet Archive?
The Internet Archive, let's see, it's got about 8 petabytes of data now. It goes mega, giga, tera, peta. So we're at about 8 petabytes. We get about 2 million users a day, different people that are using the collections. So it's encouraging that people actually want old stuff. We've got about 500,000 people using the Wayback Machine, which is trying to be a collection of all websites. So all websites and all pages on all websites.
Yeah,
we've been collecting that since 1996.
The Wayback Machine's a big source of embarrassment for me here at WFMU, because you have not our earliest web pages, but you have pages from our website from 1996, which are downright embarrassing.
Yeah, well, just take a look at MIT's if you ever want to feel better about yourself. In general, things looked a little hokey back then. It's nice to be able to see the evolution of the web, but it's also nice to be able to hold some people accountable. Go back and see either their privacy policies or whatever their offers were, and be able to go and say, hey, wait a minute, you said this. And we find that often people try to go back to their website and just sort of wipe things off and think that it's gone. But the idea of holding organizations accountable, and having out-of-print web pages. The average life of a web page is about 100 days before it's either changed or it disappears.
And does the Internet Archive actually spider the entire internet? Like every night, are you out there copying every page online?
Yep, it's a continuous process. So it takes about 2 months to just sort of do a sweep, if you will. And we've been doing that since 96. Alexa Internet also contributes its collections to the Internet Archive. And it's kind of an impossible task because the Internet's, well, effectively infinite. If you sort of think of the chess-playing websites, you know, you can't get every potential computer-generated page, but we're trying towards getting what it is people did, or, you know, whether it, and sometimes we're better at some areas than others, but we're collecting billions of web pages. We now have 150 billion web pages from over 100 million, couple hundred million websites.
Wow. And I just wanted to mention to our listeners that they can call in with questions at area code 201-209-9368. We're talking to Brewster Kahle, founder and digital librarian of archive.org, also known as the Internet Archive. And you can also make text comments or questions on our playlist page at WFMU.org. Just follow to where it says playlist and comments. And Brewster, when a new service comes out on the internet, like Twitter, do you sit down and start strategizing how you're going to copy every single tweet that goes out?
Yeah, we've tried, but we've actually sort of, that's not the most proud days in our lives. We've missed, actually. We don't get most of Twitter. We get the popular things of Twitter, and it's actually how we learn of the YouTube videos that we want to go and archive. Is we just watch Twitter for all YouTube links and then go and archive those. But for instance, we missed Napster just completely. Maybe one of the best music libraries ever built, which was burned by a stroke of a pen of a judge. And we weren't on the ball. So there are whole services that we've missed. But we've been trying to do what we can. We've been working pretty hard to keep up with the web. And now some software. There's books we're very active in. We've been archiving television for about 10 years.
So this may come off as a naive question, but when I was telling my wife about what I was going to be talking with you about tonight, she had a naive but kind of profound question, which is, why are you doing this? Why are you trying to archive the entire world and the entire internet?
It's really based on a sort of analogy, if you will, that it seemed to work in other times, that the idea of having access to the collective works of humankind has been a win. So the original look of all libraries is we all look back to the Library of Alexandria. And by going and pulling together the works from all over the world and translating them then into ancient Greek, they were able to come up with fantastic discoveries. They knew how big the world was. They knew it was round. They knew how big it was within a couple percent. Euclid authored Elements, which is what it is I still studied as geometry in high school. So fantastic things can come of it if you can leverage the works of other people. And the reason why I got involved in the whole area of building the library back in 1980 was just kind of on that analogy and the thought that if we're going to be, this technology allows us to do this, and it seems like a good thing to do. But there's another step that's kind of amazing, is it's all intermingled now with computers. So there are now computers and sort of the world's literature and everything else kind of all jumbled up together. And I went to school and technical school and studied artificial intelligence, and the idea of an artificial intelligence is it's quite doable. It may not be quite as separate as the way we imagined it then, where there'll be these separate Borgs over there and we'll have to go and fight with them. But it's now much more intertwined. I think of Google as sort of an interesting organization. It's mostly machines. It's machines with content. And so we now have this combination, which is much more popular and much more powerful than just having books on shelves. So that idea was in the air, sort of in the 1980s. And I said, I don't know, let's go build that. And so far, so good.
And you actually began building the Internet Archive in the 80s.
Well, building a lot of the earlier technologies. First, we needed computers that could help search things. So I guess computers then were pretty terrible. So I helped build supercomputers, and we made them so they can search materials, and then made it so you could remotely connect to them. That was the early 90s. Then the World Wide Web came up later. So I helped by building the first internet publishing system and early search, probably the first internet search engine. So anyway, once we can get the publishing going online, which was sort of by 94, 95, then we could turn to build the library. So that's when we started the archive in 96.
And it seems to me that having a gigantic library like the Internet Archive is a form of artificial intelligence. And Alan Turing, the great mathematician and theorist, just celebrated his 100th birthday, and he postulated that artificial intelligence will be achieved when a human being can converse with a computer and not know that he or she is conversing with a computer. That's, I guess, the idea of the Turing test. Do you accept that as the only definition of artificial intelligence?
I think it's an interesting test. It's sort of like that, you know, can computers beat us at chess, and now check. Going and defeating the top human at Jeopardy, I thought was a stunning achievement. But I guess I'm not quite looking for the cyborgs, you know, walking around and looking sexy. I just like them to be kind of interesting and useful to be around. And I'd say we're already there. I certainly look at my kids, and they're plugged into screens and interacting with other people and other computers, and having it be a pretty smooth interface that makes it sort of, it's hard to tell a lot of the time exactly why is it you're attracted. Is it the person on the other side? Yes. Is it the technology? Yes. Is it the built-up knowledge that's built into these systems? Yes. We're building a kind of a cyborg human mush.
Okay, we have the first question from somebody listening on our comments board. The glowing one wants to know, what are the strategies for the Internet Archive on data rot and data migration?
Good questions. So how do you deal with, if you can actually collect this stuff, then what do you do with it? And how do you keep it going? I think there's a few different areas. There's just trying to keep the material such that the bits that you have today, you'll have tomorrow. And that's by basically making copies. We have to move it on to new media every 3 to 5 years. And so we've been doing that for the last couple decades. So that actually is kind of doable as long as you've got continuity in your organizational structures. So that's one way. Then there's trying to get it so that it's accessible. So how do you go and deal with old formats? And you have to just keep moving it forward. But the thing that I've really found out of this is you really need a lot of copies. You need multiple copies. If the Library of Alexandria had gone and made a copy and put it into India or China, we'd have the other works of Aristotle, the other plays of Euripides, which we don't. And it was because they only had one copy, and kind of the idea of universal knowledge kind of faded from being popular as the Dark Ages set in. So we have now made partial copies and put them in the new Library of Alexandria in Egypt, which, by the way, is one of the most beautiful places to visit ever. So highly recommend it. And also in Amsterdam. And so we now have partial copies in a couple different places. If there are 5 or 6 places with active organizations going and keeping them going, and also there are large-scale swap agreements, then I could feel safe. We're also trying out, we're starting out some experiments with BitTorrent to sort of see, can it help not only in access but in preservation, so we can get more of a distributed infrastructure that doesn't depend on large organizations. What happens to libraries over time is they're burned, and they're generally burned by governments. Just historically, that's not a political statement, it's just historically true. So let's design for it. Let's go and make sure there are copies in different regions that are on different political rampages at different times, and I think that we have an opportunity to at least build things that will last for centuries.
We're talking to Brewster Kahle, founder and digital librarian of the Internet Archive, archive.org, here on Radio Free Culture, a new monthly show here on WFMU that will take place the last Monday of every month. Now, Brewster, you've been there on the Internet since long before there even was a World Wide Web. Can you talk about how the original intentions and the original designs of the Internet have been changed, and I would think for the most part for the worse?
Well, I got involved in it from the university angle, and from that perspective, we saw it as a government program. So ARPANET, going to the Internet, was sort of military-oriented, sort of research and educational networks. And then it had an interesting merging, at least for me. So I helped build a bunch of that sorts of things in the 1980s, in the late 1980s. Then I met up with the guys that came at it from the modem perspective, much more human-oriented. That they were Mark Graham, who started PeaceNet, Mitra, who started GreenNet in England. And these were people that were trying to hook people together to be able to get political things done. It was a very different angle from how the university side was going on, and they developed these whole systems of communities and how to communicate. And so there was a merging of those worlds sort of in the 1990 or, first few years of the 1990s. The World Wide Web helped things a great deal just to make it so you could point and click and move around, so you didn't have to have the expensive technologies that, or the clunky technologies that came before that. Then there was that wild commercialization thing that happened in the late 90s. And it was 1992, I was in a meeting at Stanford University, and I held up my hand and I was like, I'm here to help people make money by being on the Internet. And that was like, oh, now are you allowed to do that? And that was sort of the, as far as things went in 1992. And now I sit in rooms and say, I'm here to help people actually have a public life on the Internet that isn't mediated just by commercial interests. So I think we've swung the pendulum too far. Fortunately, there is a role, and the growing nature of things like Wikipedia or the Internet Archive or Linux or EFF, public knowledge, public library of science, we're now starting to get these nonprofit organizations that are really infrastructure organizations. We're able to build operating systems, and the number five most popular website is Wikipedia. That's pretty darn impressive that it's all nonprofit. I have a lot of faith in this sort of secular nonprofit structures that we're building up around technology.
I guess what I was getting at in terms of the architecture being spoiled, or the massive walled gardens that we have on the Internet, such as Facebook and the iTunes Store. How does archive.org get at these walled gardens?
Let's just build an alternative that's much more fun and interesting. The last, when we had the AOL versus the World Wide Web, that was also sort of walled garden versus Wild West. And frankly, just being out in the Wild West was more fun. It was just more interesting. That was where the happening stuff was going on. It wasn't contained and controlled. We have to keep the open environment so that it doesn't feel like it's just spam-filled. I don't know, email is starting to just feel like it's just a drag. And that's why people are retreating towards systems that are kind of moderated and controlled by single corporations. And that's all around scary. Also, we're starting to see things like the cell phone world and Apple starting to really give up on the general purpose platform. It all has to come from them. That's not going to come up with the next generation of really great applications if it has to be okayed by the incumbents. So having a bit of a wild and woolly world, keeping it fun and interesting, is something that we see at the Internet Archive as absolutely critical to not only the survival of our own organization, but sort of what it is we're here to help foster. So we help support things like the EFF and Wikipedia, and we use Ubuntu, and I do use Apple products, but they're really kind of going a little closed.
What do you think about the rumors going around that Apple is ultimately going to eliminate browsers from their platform?
Browsers are starting to get just embedded and blended in with their world. I haven't heard that particular rumor. I think we've just got to keep focusing on the open world. We can't just slam the door such that the next guy just can't come along and make something better than we did. The idea of going and saying, well, you know, all right, we have all the apps we need, we're done. It's just not the way we should make things go. It's not the way to have an intellectual history that grows and changes and is full of the new ideas that are needed. That clearly the generation that's in charge right now is not doing that great a job. So let's make sure that there's some openings towards doing something a little differently and hopefully a whole lot better.
We're talking to Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive. And if you have questions you'd like to ask him, our phone number is 201-209-9368, or you can leave a question or comment in text form on the WFMU homepage at WFMU.org and go to playlist and comments. Brewster, you're on the steering committee for the new Digital Public Library of America project. Can you tell us what that's all about?
Yes, there's a group of libraries that were working with Google to digitize a lot of books. And there was a sort of counter project, which was one that I helped run towards making openness. The Google libraries got tangled up in courts and then got stopped in the courts. And there's sort of this question of, okay, what do we do now among them? And some of them got together and started the Digital Public Library of America. And they're trying to learn from some of the lessons of the Google project. And we'll see sort of what happens out of that particular project. But I think there's a lot of countries are doing things that are definitely in the open domain, which I'm very, very excited about. Actually, China, for one, is digitizing a lot of books within the Department of Education, making things available all within legal constraints to make things open and available. There are about 500 members of the Open Content Alliance that are trying to build open libraries that don't have centralized points of control. So I think it's too early to tell what's going to happen on the Digital Public Library of America, but I think there's good things happening in the books realm around lending, digital lending of scanned materials. So books that are digitized from the 20th century that aren't the current bestsellers are being lent using the same constriction technologies that the publishers use for their imprint books, but these are then lent and borrowed for 2 weeks, and then it comes back. So there's only one person at a time that can have these old dusty musties, but it is bringing access now to hundreds of thousands of books out there on the net. So there are ways of working with the within the sort of library metaphor, if you will, to do format shifting of some of the older materials into the newer technology so you can read them on your iPads or iPhones. So if you go to openlibrary.org, which is a website that we built and run, there's 10,000 books for everybody, and then in a lot of libraries like Boston Public Library and a lot of other libraries, if you go in, there's 200,000 books that are available. So I'd recommend sort of seeing how that's evolving as a mechanism of trying to deal with balancing the interest between commerce and access to information.
We have a question from listener Boss in the Netherlands. He wants to know, is there a way that you place value on what goes into the Internet Archive? Is a value judgment made, or do you just try to get everything across the board?
We really try to get everything across the board, but we do have to go and sort of point our machines in different directions. So we've been trying towards the popular or the ephemeral. So we started with the World Wide Web because it was the most transient. And then we started archiving television and 20 channels of television at DVD quality, Russian, Chinese, Japanese, Iraqi, Al Jazeera, BBC, CNN, NBC, Fox. But, you know, 20 channels wasn't everything. We've now upped it to around 100 channels.
So are you are archiving 100 channels of worldwide TV 24 hours a day?
Yes. We can't make it terribly available yet, and we're trying to figure out how to get it more available. We did September 11th through September 17th, and that's up on the archive.org, archive.org/911. It's a little hard to watch, but it's interesting to see what, you know, how did the Palestinians react? How did the Russians react? There was this theory that the there was some American TV stations saying that the Palestinians were dancing in the streets. Well, were they? Well, you turned to Palestinian television. It turns out you have a very different point of view. So I think we now understand that news comes with a point of view. And it's now been really brought home in the United States. But, of course, those that watched really closely, of course, knew this forever. But I think it's now widespreadly accepted. So if we're going to think critically about this major cultural thing, which is television, then we're going to want to be able to quote it and compare and contrast. And that's very difficult to do. So that's what we learned in high school on how to write a good essay, but you can't really do that. You can do that with a newspaper, but you can't do that with television. So we'd like to try to get that to happen.
I guess, speaking of the ephemeral nature of the internet, I guess the elephant in the room might be pornography, which is, I guess, a great driver of commerce and technology online. And there's a huge amount of pornography sites that come and go. Do you make any attempt to grab any of those?
Yes, but we only get the free stuff. So we haven't gone and subscribed and then gone and archived the other sections. Pornography is what a fan what an interesting role it plays in our in society, but it's often been sort of under the table. I talked with one of the leaders, former leaders of the Library of Congress. He said, "You know, the stuff just gets stolen. You know, it gets submitted because it's got copyright, you know, deposit requirements in the Library of Congress, but it just goes away." Macromedia required that people send in a couple copies of the DVD CDs that use their software. This was accumulated. This is during the 1980s and 90s. It would accumulate, but the pornography would just get kind of stolen.
So you're saying that the copies of Hustler and Swank in the Library of Congress are walking?
Well, I can't say it, but at least some of it. Some of it. It's just kind of interesting. Anyway, so we're doing what we can on the sort of on the publicly available materials, but we haven't done a concerted real effort in that particular genre. There are other areas that we have taken real efforts, like the work of Rick Prelinger to archive ephemeral films, old educational films, advertisements, industrial films, those sorts of things. And he's now moved to we've worked with him, and we've digitized a lot of those films, put them up on archive.org. And they're fantastically popular. They're downloaded hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of times for the most popular of these things. And I'm not really quite sure why. Maybe people, it's kitsch. Maybe they're remaking things into their own movies. All sorts of reasons. But he's now moving into home movies. So the idea of taking all of these old films that are sort of raw documentation of life at a different time is actually interesting to people. It's not just your family. So I think there's areas of ephemeral materials that we're pretty good at.
Now, what are some of the legal concepts that allow the Prelinger archives to be freely available? I know that, for one thing, if the government produced a film, then that is freely available as public domain. But are there other such concepts like that?
Oh, boy. Copyright stuff is just endlessly complicated and really contorted. Not the best person to ask. There's certainly areas that sort of are made available, and it's not a problem. So things that are before 1923, you had to register copyrights between 1923 and 1964 and then re-register it 28 years later. It's sort of a whole incantation. But even, you know, you have to take things to appeal courts to be able to figure out if some things are copyrighted or not. So there's an evolution of this, of just sort of, well, what are the protected areas that we want to make sure stay clear of commerce? And then there's other things that are sort of moving forward. You think of YouTube, and there's all sorts of stuff on YouTube. And there's just more and more deals going on to try to figure out what are the right lines for this internet age. We don't want to interfere with those that are really concerned about particular things. So, for instance, on the Wayback Machine, we archive people's websites. But a lot of these websites weren't really designed for forever. And so people either put a robot exclusion on their website, which we then respect retroactively, or they write to archive.org, info@archive.org, and we'll take things out of the Wayback Machine. And that type of respectful, quick dealing with the issues seems to be working out quite well.
What are the reasons that most people would prefer their older pages to be taken off of the Wayback Machine?
Often they're embarrassed by what things might have been on there. Time to move on, I think, is some of what we hear anecdotally. Things that they just didn't really intend to last the ages. Well, if people go to the Internet Archive, archive.org, and they type in their old college web page that they, you know, built up their blog or whatever, often there's sort of this, wow, ooh, sort of, that's really cool, it's there, or it's not there. And then there's, wow, am I better off or worse off because it's there?